Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, another CMPD officer involved shooting results in protests and some emotional reaction from city council. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments in North Carolina's political gerrymandering case, but justices appear reluctant to take a stand. The long-awaited Mueller report goes to the attorney general and reaction begins. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham says it removes a cloud from the president and asks for an investigation of the FBI. And the sexual scandals afflicting the Catholic Church reach into the Charlotte Diocese. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others, and those reporters include Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. Jonathan Lois here. He's a reporter for Spectrum News.
Good morning, Mike.
And Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, and a contributor to WCCB-TV is also here. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
And Glenn Berkins is editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Good to see you again.
Last but not least.
Well, I'll move you next time.
Never least, Glenn. Never.
Somebody has to go last. That's just how it works. On Monday evening, there was a deadly officer-involved shooting at a Burger King on Batesford Road. Stories are mixed about exactly what happened, but the official story at one point said the chain of events began with a 911 call about a man with a gun at the restaurant near I-85. CMPD Chief Kerputney says the man was acting kind of suspicious, giving employees an uneasy feeling.
They call us. We get here, engage the subject who is armed. There are multiple commands to drop the weapon as we engage him outside in the parking lot. At some point, the officer, one of the first arriving officers, perceived a lethal threat, fired at least one round, striking the subject.
And it didn't take long for some members of the public to react.
Shoot first, ask questions later. That's what it is.
Who the hell
that's what it is. They already know.
You see me?
Shoot first, ask questions later.
She just showed me my name.
Shoot first and ask questions later. That was the primary chant. Those were onlookers who gathered across the street following the shooting. There was also a school walkout, I'm told, over this incident. Are we still unclear about precisely what happened that night?
I believe we are, but we could get some answers soon. Just last night, the chief held that community meeting, and I know that he said to at least the media that were there, there is body cam video in that they will not fight a judge releasing that video.
And police say that 27-year-old Danquirius, is that how you pronounce his name?
Danquirius.
Danquirius Napoleon Franklin was armed and involved in a dispute with his old girlfriend and her new boyfriend, if that's correct. 911 was dispatched after a person in the restaurant reported that he had a gun. Did police see that gun?
I don't think we know.
Right.
These are often fluid situations, and we've seen enough of these situations to know that it's probably wise to withhold judgment in terms of what happens until that police video is released.
I know that there were two 911 calls as well,
okay,
Mike, reporting that.
And it was reported that Mr. Franklin had been hospitalized for several days at Behavioral Health Services in the past because of some personal problems. Has that been confirmed?
I believe it has. The chief did mention that yesterday.
We know if that is alleged to have played a role in his behavior, alleged behavior at the restaurant on Monday morning.
Again, I think, you know, you listen to the 911 calls, and the people that called in were pretty emphatic about someone with a weapon threatening employees now and other people in the restaurant. As we have seen in the past with these, there is a lot of stuff that is said and put on social media. One of the things, and this has not been confirmed, is that maybe Danquirius Franklin was not the person that was the subject of that 911 call or those 911 calls. But again, that's something that has gotten on social media and has kind of snowballed. So it's this fight against facts until we have in this day and age, you need video proof, and that could come, like I said, with the body cam video.
And that muddling of the waters there plays into something that Vanessa Cloud, who was alleged to be one of Franklin's childhood friends, told WBTV, that the police description of her friend, Mr. Franklin, was the complete opposite of the person she knew.
He's pretty much a loving, caring person. He loves basketball. He loves his kids, his friends, his family. So, I mean, that's definitely not the person that I know.
So CMPD said that they found a gun on the scene. Don't know where it was, in the restaurant or in the environs, but they found this gun on the scene. Have they yet been able to tie that gun and the ownership of that gun to Mr. Franklin?
Again, there are... In talking to, there were several reporters of us that were out there, and you hear the gun was on the ground, the gun was on him, the gun was somewhere in the parking lot. Again, there is so much out there that has not been confirmed.
Because
yet.
The police, at one point, Chief Putney said he wasn't sure that Franklin had been holding a weapon when the shooting occurred, but he was getting verbal commands from the officers on the scene to drop the gun, drop the weapon. That has yet to be cleared up.
Correct. I am really interested, and I keep bringing this up, I'm really interested in seeing this body cam video, because the officer-involved shootings that I've covered in the last year have not all, the chief has not come out this quickly and say, we will not fight it being released, because as we know, we have the whole process of, you know, the judge has to approve the video being released. So,
but correct me if I'm wrong, they typically have not fought.
There have been in the last year of the officer-involved shootings that I've covered where they have asked for the judge not to or to hold off on releasing the video. They eventually complied, but at first, with that new law, they have asked for the judge to hold off.
Wow. Chief Putney evidently held a community conversation last night.
Yes.
About this incident over on the west side, West End, how they now call it. What happened at that meeting? What do we know about that meeting?
Well, it was certainly tense. It was held at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, which is just down the block from the Burger King. It's on Bates Ford Road. And the chief made sure when they put this out on Twitter and on social media that they were going to have this community meeting, made sure to say right off that they would not be answering any questions about what happened in the shooting. This was to come and address community concerns about what we just heard in that tape there of shoot first, ask questions later, the mm-hmm. concern about the relationship between marginalized people in our community, African Americans, and the police, the problems with trust there. Now, we did have groups who have been protesting this week, groups like Charlotte Uprising, wanting answers from the chief, just community members. And so there were points where the chief was up at the front of the church answering questions. And it did get tense. There were even some people who used expletives in the church. And the pastor got up and said, you know, this is going to be a place where we can talk about this situation and have a respectful conversation, but you will not come in here and be disrespectful. So it was tense.
So the fact that we have an African-American police chief does not diffuse the situation, or would it have been worse had he not been African-American?
I don't think it really matters in a situation like this. I think these cases tend to build on each other, and it's not about this latest shooting. It's
so
about
shoot this first, latest. Shoot first, ask questions later. The chant that developed across the street as the investigation was going on, is that based on previous incidents or what they perceive to have happened in this incident?
I think it goes to the implicit bias training that CMPD that people have been pushing for, saying that just because you are black does not mean that you cannot shoot another black person. And that is
Was the officer involved? She was female.
Correct.
Was she black?
But in past shootings, you know,
I don't think
the Keith Scott shooting, it was a black officer.
I don't think it's about CMPD at all. I don't think it's necessarily about this shooting, as I was saying. I think these things build on each other, whether it's here or whether it's in another police jurisdiction or,
absolutely,
for that matter, another state. Mm-hmm. There is a perception out there, right or wrong, that there is a that in certain situations involving young African-American males that police officers are too quick to pull the trigger.
Mary.
Yeah, I believe it's not, as Glenn was saying, a black or white. It is blue. And it's not in a vacuum. And that's why the chief realized he had to get into the community and talk about it, because all of these things build on one another. You can see it, you know, right now, the situation that's going on in Chicago, where a lot of people are saying that the Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the chief of police, who also is black, that they are very outraged about the situation with Jesse Smollett. And let's face it, you know, his story is shady, I will say that. But they were saying, where was this outrage when you had Laquan McDonald getting shot 16 times, and the police officer who was convicted of murder got 7 years? And everybody knows these stories that are going on now. So it is a situation that is ongoing, of the trust between police and the communities they cover, and we'll see it reflected any time something like this happens. I think these communities want to be policed, but they just want to be policed to have response accountability, as they would in any neighborhood in Charlotte, and that most of the people in the neighborhood are thought of as law-abiding citizens when the police do investigate. But it's going to get heated because, as Glenn said, these emotions are building from city to city.
I said before on this show, convicting a police officer of a shooting is one of the toughest things to do in the judicial system. We saw the situation in North Charleston where the where a traffic stop, a man was running away, and we saw the officer shoot the man in the back. Mm-hmm. And that first trial, was that a hung jury?
Or yes, there was
it
one.
Ended in a hung jury. And I don't think many people, or at least I think a lot of people thought that would probably be a slam dunk conviction. Right. We saw it with our own eyes, yep. But it wasn't. And all of those things play into this, that there is a feeling that there is one set of laws for us, and then there is another set of laws for the police officers.
Jonathan.
I was just going to add that, you know, the chief being there last night, right as he was headed there, we did have the horrific shooting on North Tryon Street. The innocent woman who was driving, I think she was headed to work or something like that, and was caught in the crossfire of a shootout. And the chief was made the point with another media before he went into that meeting, saying, I wish people would get this enraged about the senseless violence in this city as they do. And he actually said it feels like people only get upset when it involves the police. But Glenn, as you were saying, you didn't necessarily think that that was kosher.
Well, both right? can
well,
be true.
I both mean,
you
can be,
you can be
right.
very upset
or you
at
make a good
these
point.
Senseless killings. And I think people are in the communities. That's why they want the police there. But when some folks outside the community say, well, what do you want? Do you want you're going to criticize the police, and you know, but you want them to police your communities. And yes, both are true.
And let's face it, there is a difference between someone out there committing a senseless act of violence and government-sponsored violence.
Absolutely.
Police officers are government officials. So yes, we have a right to expect more from our government.
It puts the police in a difficult situation. If you're responding to a 911 call about somebody at a fast food restaurant who allegedly has a gun, and the police officers say, drop the weapon, which indicates that they have seen a weapon, and they find ultimately a weapon on the scene that may or may not be the victim's weapon, and in this case, the victim alleged perpetrator, what are they supposed to do?
I agree wholeheartedly, and which is why I said early on, I think it's best that we not mm-hmm. judge any individual situation until we know the facts.
Yes.
Definitely. Well, this seeped into city council, and when we come back from the break, we will hear some city council reactions to what happened on Monday morning, because the council met Monday night. We'll also hear about North Carolina's interface with the Supreme Court on gerrymandering. That's all upcoming and more on Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup, and that is why Glenn Berkins is here. He's the editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Jonathan Lowe's been doing a lot of talking because he covered the incident with the Spectrum News, and I'm glad you were here this morning.
Of course.
Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com and also WCCB, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. You can all watch the back of Mary C. Curtis's and Jonathan's head on Facebook Live this morning. All right, so because of what happened on Monday morning in the aftermath of what's been going on around the country and, of course, here in Charlotte with the Keith Scott shooting and what happened downtown because of that, there was reaction. It seeped into the city council meeting on Monday night, and Mayor Vi Lyles became pretty emotional while talking about this.
We must always remember that loss of life is someone's child, and for that, we are truly, truly sorry that any kind of loss has to occur like that. Keeping order is not always an easy thing. Losing someone is really, really difficult.
Councilmember Braxton Winston, who came into public consciousness during the protests following Keith Scott shooting with that iconic photograph in the Observer of him with his T-shirt off and his arm raised in the air, said police have to find a different way to deal with people who are perceived as threats.
Municipal government should not be in the business of killing people. But that, again, happened today. Whether it was justified, right or wrong, we are not better off at this moment than we were before 9 a.m. this morning.
And Winston said the shooting did not live up to a sacred duty. And those comments drew this response from Republican Councilmember Ed Driggs.
I just hope that you'll make the same speech every time we get news that somebody has been murdered in Charlotte, because those lives matter too.
How did folks take that comment?
Well, it almost sounds like what the chief said last night.
Which is?
That we have a senseless killing. I bring up again the awful story of the woman yesterday who was just driving on 28th Street in North Tryon, and that happened as the chief was headed to that community meeting. Clearly he was upset about it and spoke to this is how people in this city are choosing to end
So Edrig's comment seems to say, you know, we don't want police arbitrarily shooting people black, white, or purple.
Correct.
On the other hand, if people have guns in the community and they're going to use them aimlessly and for no reason whatsoever, and people get hurt, are you going to bemoan that fact as well?
Well, the standards for it also are so loose in the sense of, or amorphous, it says, police officers, if they fear for their lives. And so that really puts a lot on them.
Right.
And they have a lot of responsibility because they do have guns, so they can have to react in a split second. And other folks want to say, well, who do you see as the threat? And do you see some people as a threat more than others? And would you be more likely to use deadly force? I thought what the mayor said was a lot more nuanced, that, we want bad, good, right, wrong, where people are complicated. And if someone, the friend who said he was a very kind person, that can be true as well as he could be a troubled person. So we have to see people as complete human beings, not just people in the community, but police officers as well. And that's just very difficult. But as Glenn said, they're the ones with the guns.
So. I was going to say, on council, that exchange between Braxton and Ed Driggs, I mean, they have that discussion not about police shootings, but about a whole number of issues all the time. They've become, I mean, Ed Driggs, I think, it feels like it's his job. They're very different politically. And they go back and forth on so many issues, even apart from police violence. And
To add to that, Steve, I mean, you were there at the meeting when the police officer came and got up and most recently said that we need an increase in our pay. Officers are leaving at a pretty large rate. And that sparked a back and forth between Braxton and Ed on how to properly pay police officers. So, yes, it's a contentious topic that rolls off in
And then there's just in between the two personalities, there's just so much even apart from this issue. It just goes to everything.
Well, that's a stand-in, I think, for this community in some ways, because we still are segregated in some ways residentially, that there'll be some folks that'll see things one way, and some will see things the other.
Well, I think it's,
and they'll just be seeking it.
We're a microcosm of what's going on in the country.
Yes,
Republican,
and
Democrat,
the world.
Conservative, liberal. There's this bifurcated split, and people tend to see the world in black and white, right or wrong. And in fact, that's not true. It's all shades of gray.
And people are even choosing their friends and associations now, they say, based on views, points of views, so you won't even really sit down and have a conversation with the other
side. And I think you guys touched on it last week when the sheriff's office went into the area around the lake to do traffic enforcement. People act very differently when they are the subject of police actions.
Right.
So even those who are strictly law and order, when the police action or the law enforcement action falls on them and their community, they react differently.
They bridle a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why aren't you after those real criminals?
Right. All right. So the U.S. Supreme Court has already struck down racial gerrymandering, the practice of drawing voting districts to favor one race over the other. On Tuesday, they finally took up our political gerrymandering case, which seems to have been with us in North Carolina forever. Common Cause and the League of Women Voters argued before the court that our state's congressional maps favor Republicans too much. No kidding. We'll talk about that in a second. How did they make that argument? What was their argument?
So I guess just a little bit of background. The map is from 2016.
Right.
After the 2016 election, Republicans won 10 of 13 seats. David Lewis in the House, when they passed the map, kind of joked and said, this is what we wanted to do. It is a partisan gerrymander. The only reason we have 10-3 is because I could not draw 11-2. So in the Supreme Court hearing, Paul Clement, representing the Republican leadership, he just said basically like that this is allowed, that the judicial system has no role in this. And then on the other side, Common Cause and the League of Women Voters took kind of different approaches. There was an interesting exchange between Justice Alito and the Common Cause attorney in which Alito asked and said, okay, what if the state said, we're only going to do a little bit of gerrymandering. We're going to do a 7-6. We still want to get an advantage. Is that okay? And the attorney said, well, and then Alito said, and they admitted to that. They said, we're going to do a 7-6. And the attorney for Common Cause says, no, you can't even do that. You can't even admit even the slightest advantage. The League of Women Voters had a little bit of a different approach. They felt like that would be okay. They were looking for just the most severe cases, and North Carolina is one of those.
Yeah, in this case, they're taking up North Carolina and also Maryland, in which it's the opposite, in which in one district they say that Democrats have favored them. And you could see the justices struggling with it because partisan gerrymandering, they've left it basically up to the states. But even Brett Kavanaugh, the newest justice, said that he would not dispute that extreme partisan gerrymandering is a real problem for our democracy, because you look at these some of these maps and you cannot deny it. And in North Carolina in particular, they've done like Asheville, for instance, is a pretty liberal city, but because of the way they've split it, sometimes with people on one side of the street in one district and the other side of the street on the other, they have represented by two of the most conservative members of Congress.
Those fighting against changing these maps, arguing for the state, essentially, in front of the Supreme Court, pointed out that the Founding Fathers put nothing in the Constitution with regard to mandating proportional representation within the states. And, of course, our Constitution also had nothing in it about racial gerrymandering either. So why is that a valid argument?
I'm not sure I would argue that it is a valid argument for the very reason you mentioned, among others.
Okay.
But the thing of it is that they also really seem that they want the states to take care of it, and in some cases, states are doing that. California, for instance, and other states have nonpartisan commissions that draw up the districts. And North Carolina has a couple of laws in place that are trying to hit that area. And so you could see the Supreme Court pretty much saying, well, can you all take care of it and not have us step on a political process with a constitutional ruling and saying that it's not constitutional.
Steve.
There was a great story in ProPublica about California's redistricting. They have this independent commission, which, like Mary said, a lot of people want to do. And in California, the story talked about how Democrats kind of said, okay, this is out of our hands now because it's a Democratic state. What are we going to do? And so the story talked about how the Democrats kind of got activists and local their people to essentially pose as activists on the ground and go to these meetings and talk about this is what we want, this is what we need over and over again. And they kind of infiltrated the system. So, I mean, I'm not saying that the commission's a bad idea. Okay. It's just the lengths to which both parties will go to preserve their power.
Well, go ahead.
One thing that I would point out, as you correctly noted, racial gerrymandering is illegal, but increasingly race and political parties are kind of proxies.
Yeah, the political gerrymandering is accomplishing what racial gerrymandering
absolutely
can't do anymore.
Absolutely. Here in North Carolina, on the campus, I think North Carolina A&T, one of the lines just splits the campus in half, right, where students on one half of the line are in one district and students on the other half are in another district.
Well, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, two justices that were put on the court by Donald Trump, suggested that partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts is already being solved by state action. Was he talking about these commissions? Mm-hmm. Is that what he was talking mm-hmm. about? Allison Riggs, who argued on behalf of the League of Women Voters before the court, was not buying that argument.
Voters can't self-correct this. You can have a democratic way of election, and to date, no congressional districts flipped in North Carolina. So I think they appreciate that, you know, what might work for voters in Colorado, putting an initiative to the voters, isn't an option for many voters, and that doesn't relieve the court of its duty to vindicate constitutional rights.
However, as you might imagine, Republican Speaker of the North Carolina House, Tim Moore, told Spectrum News that drawing these maps should be left in the hands of state lawmakers.
I certainly don't think courts need to be in the business of drawing districts. There are those who say we ought to have an independent commission. Well, those folks aren't elected. They're not directly accountable to the voters. So my argument would be that if you take this responsibility away from the legislature, you would then be taking the power away ultimately from the people.
So if voters in North Carolina took the speaker at his word and take the power, how would they go about forcing the legislature to draw districts more fairly? What power do the people have in terms of influencing either the legislatures to draw these or to influencing the legislature to allow a referendum to do it in a nonpartisan way?
I mean, it's just be to vote in legislators who want to do
that. Can it be done?
Well, if they legislate, I mean, a lot of things are going to come up because of the 2020 census and these elections, which will put a lot of folks in there who will be redrawing these districts. So that's why it's incredibly important right now. But they bring up the examples of states like North Carolina and Wisconsin. The vote is pretty split when you look at it between Democrats and Republicans. But yet when you look at the representation, it's, you know, really skewed in place of Republicans. And you look at a state like Pennsylvania, where the state Supreme Court and a lot of folks are going through the state Supreme Courts because the state constitutions make it easier to fight it, and they ruled that their lines were unconstitutional and drew new lines, and you saw the result in 2018, where in Pennsylvania it's now much more even between Democrats and Republicans. And folks like, to go back to Glenn's point about racial gerrymandering and partisan gerrymandering being similar, folks like Eric Holder, former Attorney General, who's now chairing this organization called the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, they make that link as well, saying that all of these gerrymandering laws are very similar to voter suppression restrictions. So it's a continuing fight, both in the states and around the country.
So Justice Kavanaugh, who through his comments acknowledged that extreme partisan gerrymandering was a problem, in
yes.
fact dangerous to democracy,
yes.
he asked Paul Clement, who is representing the state, about proportional representation. He asked, quote, why can't the Equal Protection Clause be interpreted to require something resembling proportional representation, to which Clement pointed out that the framers of the Constitution gave the legislatures the power to draw these voting districts. Could this be as simple as the court ruling that these legislators then have the power, but they have to draw the districts in a way to ensure proportional representation? Could they just make that ruling?
I mean, I think they could, but I think one of the problems with proportional representation is, like, look at a state like Massachusetts, and they talked about this in the hearing. Democratic state, all Democratic congressmen. So 35% of the electorate in Massachusetts are Republicans, but the way they're spread out, they're just kind of all over the state. So it's actually kind of hard to draw a Republican district in Massachusetts. But under proportional representation, they would need third of the seats, four quarter of the seats. So I think the big issue with this is just where do you draw the line? How do you say this is good and this is bad, and that's it's just really difficult
for people who are only
congressmen and women.
For people who for people who are only peripherally interested in this, this actually is incredibly important, and there is an urgency to this. You wrote a column about this in Roll Call. We did a program about this on Monday, and both your column and that program pointed out something that is the same thing, that because of computers.
Yes.
And the ability to draw these districts with laser precision, that if we don't do something, the voters are going to lose confidence in democracy and the voting system. Why vote? It doesn't matter.
It's true. It's become more of a case of politicians picking their voters rather than voters picking the politicians, because they can look not only at your party, but how you voted in the last elections. And that's why you get these incredibly circuitous districts, because people are doing it. So it used to be done, but it was cruder. Now it is down to a science.
It is, and it is a science.
Yes, it's a science.
So what happens next? There's a Maryland case that's approaching the Supreme Court. As you said, you pointed out that the Republicans are complaining in that case. It's one district, not the whole state, but the whole state of Maryland is about the size of one of our districts. But
I'm from Maryland. Wait a minute, they have a Republican governor,
right? But the Republicans there are saying that the Democrats shut them out through gerrymandering out of one district. So that case is coming to the Supreme Court. Will they hear that case before handing down a decision on ours? And could either case affect the other?
Well, they've kind of put them both together for this, for these hearings. And it's fascinating because the Republican governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, and the Democratic governor of North Carolina, Roy Cooper, wrote a joint op-ed in the Washington Post, but both basically saying this partisan gerrymandering is a bad idea.
And they could, and the court can do any number of things. They could decide these cases very narrowly, or they could issue a sweeping ruling that would say that would uphold or strike down partisan gerrymandering.
So I have 30 seconds left before the break, but the 2020 census is looming large, and all of this starts over again as a result of the 2020 census.
It does.
When can we expect a decision, one way or the other, or no decision at all from the court?
If there's a decision, they're thinking it's probably going to be in June sometime. And then you have even the census, with your question about citizenship, is under investigation. So even that's not settled.
So we get reaction to the Mueller report, or at least the summary of the Mueller report being released, and the Charlotte Catholic Diocese in the news. We'll talk about that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison joins us from our newsroom at WFAE. Jonathan Lowe is here from Spectrum News. Glenn Berkins, who refuses to go last, is the QCityMetro.com editor and publisher. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call.
So I go last.
You got to let me live that down, Mike.
At WCCB. Okay. The summary of the Mueller report was released over last weekend by Attorney General Barr, who said that Mueller was unwilling to say whether or not the president was guilty of obstruction. He says the report does reveal that there was no collusion with Russia and the Trump campaign. And Barr went on to say that the president was exonerated. Of course, the Democrats want the full report because they think that there's more to it than that. And the president has said he's okay with the attorney general releasing the entire report, but the attorney general seems to be prevaricating on that. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked a resolution on Monday that would have called on Barr to release that report to the public. So there's disappointment on one side and euphoria on the other. Is it premature?
Definitely.
I
because
believe so.
We don't have – it's over 300 pages. We don't know what's in it. Also, there are – other investigations going on in Congress, oversight, and also in all of these other courts that Mueller passed off some of these investigations to the Southern District, New York, and others. And so we don't know what's going on. But of course, it's going to be a political football. President Trump was at a rally last night saying he was exonerated, although the summary said you're not exonerated. And Republicans want Adam Schiff to step down from the Intelligence Committee. And he's saying, are you kidding? There's still a lot out there. The thing I think is fascinating, though, that, well, one is that Mueller was supposed to get beyond the politics, but he handed it back
right.
to the Attorney General. And also, the one thing everyone agrees on, the report and the intelligence, is that Russia interfered with our elections, and they're doing it again.
It got pretty heated yesterday in the Intelligence Committee with some very strong words being aimed at Adam Schiff by Republicans who were insisting that he needed to resign, that they had lost all confidence in his ability to chair that committee. Did anything similar to that happen when Devin Nunes was running that committee, when the Republicans were in charge and the Democrats were angry because he seemed to be meeting with the White House on a regular basis?
Something similar did happen. There were calls for him to
So this is quid pro quo?
Probably.
Okay. The letter that Barr wrote summarizing his impressions of the Mueller report has emboldened the president, as you just mentioned. He's calling for an investigation of the FBI now, among other things. And if you thought that this at least temporary exoneration of the president was going to make everything hearts and flowers again in Washington, you were wrong. And South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham is leading the charge. He was pleased, but also ready for a fight.
I believe that Donald Trump got scrutiny like nobody else in the history of the presidency, since Nixon, probably. And he, in my view, came out of this thing stronger. To those who were abusive of the process in 2016 on the other side, you haven't had much scrutiny, but that's coming.
That sounds like a threat.
I would remind him of a president named Clinton who came under investigation for an obscure land deal in Arkansas.
And didn't he lead the charge? Didn't Senator Lindsey Graham lead the charge on that? Probably?
Right, and he ended up being impeached tangentially over an affair with a White House intern. So when he says that no president has been scrutinized as much, that just doesn't bear
facts. So Lindsey Graham said the report removes a cloud from the Trump presidency, but he also called for an investigation of the FBI and the Justice Department to look for Trump bias. Simple question. Yes, sir. I mean, I don't know how you'd answer this quickly, but who would investigate? If you're investigating both the FBI and the Justice Department, who's going to do it? CMPD?
He wants them to call another special counsel to appoint another one, which I doubt is happening.
And also, the interesting part is he would be investigating people he appointed.
Yes, because all of these people, they say it's a Democratic plot, but these are all of them are Republicans. Mueller, Comey was, all of these folks.
McCabe.
McCabe, yeah. Rosenstein.
Rosenstein.
Yeah, all of them. And they were appointed. And, you know, it also, for something that was supposedly a witch hunt, it's caught a lot of witches, I guess.
So the president has characterized some of the things done during this investigation as treasonous. I'm not sure exactly what he's referring to, but because he just points these things out. And once again, he brought up the Steele dossier in his comments. That's the document that alerted the FBI to possible Trump ties to Russia. It was given to the late Senator John McCain, who then consulted with his friend Lindsey Graham, and it was Lindsey Graham who said, turn it over to the FBI. And it was the turning over of that document to the FBI that really got the president hot under the collar. But it was Lindsey Graham's idea. You can't make this stuff up.
And Lindsey Graham is now the president's new best friend.
That's right.
And now also you have to know that all these folks that were indicted and have served time and guilty pleas, like Papadopoulos and Manafort, they are angling for some pardons right now.
And all of this happened during the Obama administration. So now Graham has said that Washington must return its focus to the storyline because it may reveal abuse of power by the Obama administration. He said it's at a minimum disturbing. Whether or not it's illegal, I don't yet know, so I'm going to get answers to this. Where does this end?
Well, the polls have shown now that across party lines, most people, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, want to see the full report. So that'll happen if William Barr let's go. He says things have to be redacted because of security purposes. So, you know, that will be where it will go. But I think, practically speaking, each side will use it for making political hay as they go around.
So it was the firing of former FBI Director James Comey by the president that kick-started this special counsel investigation. And after spending an hour with us recently on this program, Comey was in town this week to speak at the Belk Theater, and he spoke about, obviously, the Mueller report, stating that he could neither charge nor exonerate the president. Mr. Mueller couldn't. And Comey called that confusing, something he echoed later in an interview with NBC's Lester Holt.
The purpose of a special counsel is to make sure that the politicals, in this case the Attorney General, doesn't make the ultimate call on whether the subject of the investigation, the President of the United States, should be held criminally liable for activities that were under investigation. And so the idea that a special counsel wouldn't reach the question and hand it to the political leadership doesn't make sense.
So we haven't seen the report. We may never see the whole report, but it maybe we'll see the report in a month. Who knows? But what role, Steve, you're our political reporter, what role is this likely to play in the 2020 election? It's already starting.
It is starting, and I think it was going to play a big role and will play a big role. But then, of course, Democrats were absolutely thrilled that the president immediately pivoted to wanting to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which was they were absolutely thrilled. I mean, because this was they had, you know, so many people had so many Democrats had invested so much in this narrative of Russian collusion. And there were probably a lot of politicians and people in the media who did have to kind of like
do a mea culpa.
Yeah. And then it just the president was able to he's going to still talk about this, but talking about health care,
I'm going to take
let people off the hook.
I'm going to take the opposite take and say I think this was already baked into the cake. I think those who support the president will continue to support him, and those who won't, I don't think this will change any minds. I think this election is going to be much more about, again, health care and civility.
Okay.
Well, the Democrats hope so, because that's how they won a lot of seats in 2018. They want to talk about it. And you see all the candidates from Elizabeth Warren to Kamala Harris to Amy Klobuchar coming out with things about infrastructure and health care. So they want to talk about the issues.
Okay. Since I used the word mea culpa, and that's Latin, let's move to the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has been embroiled in sexual scandals for years. Nothing new about that. They've taken heat not only on the sexual impropriety of certain priests, but for how the church has handled those cases and when they were uncovered, and for the cover-up when they were not uncovered. Yesterday, the chancellor of the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte stepped down after what the diocese called a credible allegation, those are their words, of sexual misconduct by Monsignor Mauricio West when he was at Belmont Abbey College in the mid-'80s. What do we know?
We know that this apparently did not, according to what they investigated, it did not involve actual sexual abuse, did not involve a minor. This was, according to the diocese, someone who was an adult. Mauricio West has denied the allegations. He says, the allegation, though, is that he made unwanted overtures over a period of time. Again, back in the mid-1980s. What's interesting is he has held that position, I believe, the longest of any person in the diocese. I actually attended Catholic school. I remember hearing about him, never met him, but heard a lot about him. Everybody knows Mo West. And so he actually oversaw two investigations, at least two investigations of sexual abuse or involving priests within the diocese. So it's interesting he's now being accused of the same thing.
It should be pointed out that Monsignor West denies these allegations. No criminal charges have been filed, might they be?
I don't know. With there not being an allegation of sexual abuse and not involving minors, I don't know. That's a slippery slope.
The Charlotte Diocese has so far resisted releasing a list of past and present priests who have been credibly accused of child sex abuse, which this was not. Let's point that out. However, other dioceses around the country have been a lot more transparent. Why hasn't our diocese, the Catholic diocese in this neighborhood, followed suit?
Well, a lot of the dioceses, even in this state and the surrounding, have released it. And their explanation so far has been that they don't want to cause the folks who might be on the list or might be affected any more harm. And survivors have said, we want the transparency, so please you know, don't take that in consideration. So you're going to see a lot more, particularly after this high-profile case, more demands to publish them.
It was announced yesterday that somebody else is stepping down. It was announced that Wells Fargo CEO Tim Sloan is retiring. He took over from former CEO John Stumpf, who resigned after those well-known scandals. Sloan's retirement takes place immediately. What's going on here?
So he actually will retire at the end of July, Mike. He's stepping down
all of his positions.
Right.
So what is he doing?
Good question.
Collecting the check.
Pulling a paycheck. Until July, a very big paycheck.
He just got a raise.
Right.
Wish you had that deal, right?
You know, what's interesting about this is that he has been saying that we're going to correct this. We're going to get the bank right back on track as far as serving its customers. But I think since 2016, the bank has paid out $4 billion in fines and settlements. And it's still, you talk to people inside the bank. I know people that work inside the bank. You know, the problems have not, and people think it's just a fake account scandal.
That was the
impetus of this whole thing. I mean, they were selling insurance to people who didn't need it. They were putting these add-ons to mortgages that didn't need it. It spread to so many parts of the bank under Tim Sloan's leadership that, you know, he has been in battle for so long. It was hard to see how he would continue.
In his statement yesterday, he said it had become apparent to him. To successfully move Wells Fargo forward will benefit from a new CEO and fresh perspectives. He's just come off of a House Committee on Financial Services hearing in which they just shot rockets at him. And then the same day that he was in that hearing, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency said they continued to be disappointed by Wells Fargo's corporate governance and risk management programs, and that's something they rarely do. What did Elizabeth Warren have to say about his stepping down, Mary?
Well, she was pretty intense about it. This is her issue, financial equity. As she said, about time, although she had a word in between about in time. Tim Sloan.
Can it be said on the radio?
No.
Okay.
Tim Sloan should have been fired a long time ago. He enabled Wells Fargo's massive fake account scam, got rich off it, and then helped cover it up. Now let's make sure all the people hurt by Wells Fargo's scams get the relief they are owed.
And Patrick McHenry, Representative Patrick McHenry, right here from our home state, he is a ranking member of the House Financial Services Committee. He was quick to put out a statement right after this. He said, quote, "The bottom line is that we have not seen the type of cultural or institutional change so desperately needed at Wells Fargo. The bank needs a change agent. I will be watching closely to ensure the next leader of the organization shows commitment to rebuilding trust."
Only a couple of seconds left, but on Tuesday, Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Superintendent Clayton Wilcox proposed a 15% hike in county funding for CMS next year, nearly half of that extra $70 million going to teacher pay and staff pay raises and more emotional support staff. That sounds like a surprise to me. Was it yes or no?
I think 15% is a lot compared to, you know, how much people are going to be paying out. We still don't know the tax rate.
Right.
And one of the things that's included in that is they're asking for an increase in the local supplement that teachers get as part of their pay.
60% of the school's funding comes from the state, and it's always a battle, it seems to me, with the county commission on their portion of the funding. And when you tack on this extra $70 million, have we heard any reaction at all from any county commissioners to this proposal?
Not yet. They haven't had a meeting since the superintendent unveiled the budget. I know that Dr. Vilma Leek is a former teacher. She was there taking notes. She's the only commissioner I actually saw at that board meeting,
right.
At that school board meeting where he unveiled his budget. So remains to be seen how they're going to react to that supplement part.
And this time you get to be last. You get the last word. Jonathan Lloyd. Reporter.
I'll take it.
Okay, from Spectrum News, Mary C. Curtis, roll call columnist and a contributor to WCCB TV. Steve Harrison is with us from WFAE News. I meant to put you last. And Glenn Berkins is editor and publisher from QCityMetro.com. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.